All right, welcome back to part two of Help Me Save the Titan by Netflix, or Netflix is the Titan. And today we're going to talk about, on this part, we're going to talk and focus in on the characters more. Now, one of the critiques, one of the criticisms was that, one, the acting was poor and bland, which, by the way, as somebody who went to film production school, right, where we made films, one of the things that was so annoying was absolutely how dumb everybody's criticisms or praise was. Like the cliche or the joke was that if you didn't know how to praise a story, like a film student story that they had on there, you would say, "Oh yeah, the cinematography was really good," right? Like, which is completely the stupidest thing ever. And if you go through Rotten Tomatoes and you read those critics, they say stupid stuff like that, but in reverse, they say the negative of it. Like, the acting was bad. Like, that's not a, you can't say that. Like, if you're going to, you have to give, you can't say it's bland. That's not, like, what was bland about it? What if there's supposed to be bland characters? And in fact, I think there is supposed to be, especially in Rick, a blandness to him. And I think he conveys what that is. And what we're going to talk about today is, well, who's the protagonist? Because we tend to think of it, if you even look at this image, Sam Worthington is like a big old head, and then you have Abigail. But who has more screen time? Abigail. So maybe Abigail's actually the protagonist here, and there's something deeper going on. And I think the fact that these critics have no concept of literary history, like if they've never taken a, like, read a book on what's going on in the world in literature. And again, if you watch part one, I talked about why those types of things, why history, like, or literature is important, even if you're not a literary person. It affects the way you view the world, as we talked about with environmentalism and anti-environmentalism in the other, in part one. So hopefully you watch that and you watch this. If not, hopefully you at least watch the movie, because we're going to talk about a lot of spoilers and different ways of looking at it. So I assume you've seen the whole story at this point. Now, the assumption, I think, is fair to say that Rick is the main character, right? It starts with him. He seems to be driving the action in a certain sense, although we learn that the doctor, or the mad scientist, and this is a cliche that goes back to Mary Shelley and Hawthorne, especially those two in particular, I think, are the most prominent and most powerful creators of the mad scientist trope. Or idea, that image that sits with us today. And we're going to talk about that. And I also want to talk a little bit about the imagery that we see in all this. So we see a lot of garden imagery. And this film is very conscious in a way that some sci-fi films aren't, you know, especially the crappy B and C sci-fi films are not as aware of. And that is the relevance in the genre of, you know, that's powerfully been implanted in the minds of audiences. So when you watch this, you don't even realize it's happening, but you already have ingested the idea that the of garden imagery, and that the world we live in, the actual earth, is a garden. That was, what is a garden? A garden is something that's cultivated, it's crafted, it's designed, it's, you know, made with consciousness. That is a religious concept. Another view, and I used to work for an organization called the Center for Industrial Progress, has the view that Earth is a crappy, barren, you know, place that's really hostile and harsh to human life. And we have to use our brains to manipulate and transform it into what is good for our ability to live on Earth. But those are two different conflicting images of Earth. One is that it's this pristine place that we should all just walk around naked and, you know, like in the Garden of Eden, you know, with Adam and Eve, and we'll be fine. We'll find berries and they'll just drop off and we'll be amazingly happy. Boo. That's not true. Anybody who's ever, you know, spent an hour, if you got lost in a national park where there's a city right around the corner and you've only been lost for 10 minutes and you're like, "Where's my water, man?" Like, you know what I'm talking about. It sucks to get, you know, for something like that to happen. Not to say that that was me. It was like, "Where's my water?" after 10 minutes. Okay. So there's garden imagery that's thematically important. So there's something very critical about the garden imagery, as well as the water imagery. So there's a lot of water in this. It's a big deal, obviously. And, we're also doing something unnatural, or supposedly unnatural, is part of the criticism in the story that we're going to talk about. So we have this garden imagery. I mean, if you look at the, let me make sure I'm sharing this with you so you can see it. So if you're not watching, hopefully you saw the movie, you know what I'm talking about there. First off, the island is a garden. It's an island set, you know, on an ocean surrounded by water. And it's this perfect green, you know, garden, just like you might imagine the Garden of Eden. But their house, which is a very kind of Frank Lloyd Wright image or place, is filled with garden. And it's filled with garden imagery. Everything, there's harsh rock cut right, you know, cut right in half. And again, it looks like a Frank Lloyd Wright in a lot of ways. And it's like it comes right out of the earth. It looks like it just came out of the earth, but it also has the element of design to it. And that's important. So we're getting this idea that man has the ability, and this is so ingrained in us that we just don't think about it. It's just natural to us that it's ingrained within us, and that it's, you know, that there's the natural world, and then there's the manipulation of the natural world. And so this forms one of the key questions in all of science fiction, from Mary Shelley to the latest B&C, you know, thriller, to Star Trek, even on a certain level. Like, all of it is shaped by this, to the Orville that just came out. They're all shaped by this type of imagery, whether they realize it or not, which they probably don't. You know, there's also something in fairy tale here. So we're going to talk a little bit about that in the future, particularly Beauty and the Beast. So if you remember what happens at the end of this movie, think of that and think about the tale of Beauty and the Beast. There's something in fairy tale land called the illusion of central position. And what that means is, you know, one, who is actually in the central position of the story? So in this case, the question is, who's the central position of this story? We tend to think of it as Rick, but I think that's an illusion. I think that's not accurate. I think the central position goes to the female, Abigail, who, by the way, in the Hebrew tradition, Abigail, the wife of King David, I believe, was known for her beauty, intelligence, and loyalty. And again, if you just watched the movie or if you've seen it recently, think about that with the character of Abigail. Okay. We're also going to learn about natural limits. That's another important garden or Eden imagery, or Eden complex, as it's been called. So natural limits, and this is the thing, that there are some things man is not meant to know, or man's reach is beyond his grasp. Man's grasp is beyond his reach. I just mixed that up. Then there's a scientist who seeks to be God or godlike. The dramatic structures are Oedipal, not Freudian, but Sophoclean. So in other words, not the idea that every man wants to kill his father and rape his mother psychologically, but the power structure of Sophocles' Oedipus Rex is the idea of the transference of power. So it's actually about the king who wants to, you know, whether he will properly transfer power to the young, you know, to the young man, his son. And he's afraid of either doing that properly or not. You also see this in Marlowe's Faustus and William Shakespeare's The Tempest. You know, one of the questions in The Tempest, and it's been a while since I've read this, I'm trying to remember exactly, but the wizard character tells, who's in charge of the island, right? They're washed off onto an island, just like in the island of Dr. Moreau. Prendick is shipwrecked, and then he washes ashore of an island, the island of Dr. Moreau, who was experimenting on making animals into men, right? And there's some scenes we're going to talk about here that harkens to that. And like I said, the Moreau, the H.G. Wells story, is probably the most relevant to this story. So if you want to read a story that will, you know, be more interesting and break, you know, in for this movie and the movie toward the Wells, I would read The Island of Dr. Moreau. But, you know, in The Tempest, you get this character who is told he can have Miranda if he can just do this little thing of move the forest. And it's a transference of power. Will he get, will the powerful person in charge give his hand, his daughter's hand, to this newcomer. All he has to do is this incredible task. Now, of course, he does it, and this is what would be called in literary history an edible comedy, and that there was a successful transference of power. Now, in the unsuccessful one, an edible tragedy, that's when Oedipus kills his father, goes and marries his mother, and there's an edible tragedy, the transference of power. So he does transfer power, but he does it uncouthly in a bad way. He missed the mark, and so there's an edible tragedy. So that's what, so this is the kind of worldview that this movie is structured in. And it's so aware of it. Like I said, the imagery is carefully selected to show that. Now, the symbol system relies on clear dichotomies. So you get a lot of air and water, tech and science, family and wider society, our world, another world, man and woman is a big one too. So let's now dive in a little bit into the movie, and we're going to look at something that I think is often overlooked, or probably wasn't looked at all with this movie, but is the way that movies convey these types of images and feelings and emotions in a way that literature does it with words. The movie uses images. So let's watch this little scene, very visual. I don't think there's any dialogue at all. So you see Rick coming in and taking boxes. They're moving into their new garden paradise home. It's a paradise of a home. So now we learn, if you're listening, Dr. Abigail Janssen, pediatric. So she's a doctor. Now, you know, one thing we kind of have to think about is that on this island, her role is not really the key role, right? That it's the illusion of central position in a certain sense. Like, it's Rick that's the key role, right? Now this, what's happening right now is going to be critical. This is production design. And I think right here is as simple as it's going to be is really good art for the context of this movie. Now look at that face. If you're listening, you can't see this, of course, and this is going to be critical. But everyone else, look. That's art, for one. I mean, it's a photograph, so it's not a painting. But there is an artisticness to it because she's in her wedding dress. He's in his officer's uniform. This tells the whole story right here. What? I've been to a couple weddings. I've never seen the main picture that would look like this. This is such a uniquely chosen picture. Why does she look like that? I mean, I feel like this character, this actress, could have been chosen merely for this look, and that would have made the movie. Because look at how he is looking at her. He is obviously in love with her. He's holding her with his hands, you know, lightly pressed against her back and her belly, and he's pulling her toward him a little bit. She has her hand reluctantly on his chest, over his heart, which, by the way, if you know classical paintings, this is a very common scene. And this looks like a painting, right? Like, it's not something you would do with the photograph. Like, in most photographs, you would, you know, tell the wife, hey, look at him. Why would she be looking? Because this is the key to this, if you're listening. She is not looking at her husband. She's looking out into the world. She's looking out of the painting, out of the photograph. She's looking away. And she has this far distant look on her face. Why? Why would someone who just got married have that look? Why would they want to choose that? Now, this is important too. So now we have four photos. So again, this is all production design. You know, technically in the film world, these would be called props because she's using them. So anything that an actor uses would be props. So these are props technically, but whatever. So if you're watching, there are four frames on camera right now, and that Abigail just placed up. So she's making a home out of this place. We don't see Rick doing that. What Rick does is we just see him once in the background lifting a box. you know, and moving off screen. So he's helping, but he's not really a part of making this a home. That's her job. And now this is a focus of her home, but notice the four things that are up here. So one is an image of her in her gown, in her graduation gown. And look how happy she is. And then the next one next to the right of that is Dr. Abigail Janssen, her certificate of, you know, her graduation diploma, pediatrics. And then next to that is an image of their wedding. So you could see a timeline of her life. And this is how these types of things are conveyed very poignantly, very powerfully in film, if you pay attention. So she's happy. She just got married. Presumably this may be before she met her husband. Now there's a character, a black lady that may or may not be, I can't tell. She may be the character that is, later one of the other, test subjects, one of the other test subjects. Now, if that's the case, that tells you a whole lot about this conflict here and what's going on, because we're going to talk about, you know, this character who turns into Homo Titanius, the forced evolution that's going on here. This female character kills her husband. Sounds kind of Oedipal to me, doesn't it? Kills her husband and then seemingly tries to convince Rick to kill his wife so that they could be together. And we see some indications of this. So there's, like I said, there's so many layers to this movie. And we're missing so much, and the critics are not doing their job, because they should be helping you see this. They shouldn't be knocking it down as bland because they don't know how to think. You know, they don't know how to think. So we have, you know, a happy Abigail with one of the other, I'm just going to assume, one of the other test subjects. Next to that, we have her diploma. And then we have this wedding picture, which is a very odd wedding picture. And then we have the clip of Rick where it's an image of him with an F-16 or some fighter plane behind him. And it says MIA hero pilot found alive in Syrian desert. So again, if you think about one of the core eating complex elements that have been identified by scholars, not me, of course, the illusion of central position is really critical. And it really seems like Rick is the hero of this story. And that's one of the illusions that if you know, one of the things, like, is he really the protagonist? Is he really pushing the plot along? Because I don't think he pushes the plot along at all. He's just he is in a sense a kind of bland, dutiful character. He's a good, strong man, but it's really a story in a sense of this young lady. And there's a lot going on here. So there's so much. I could talk forever about this. I mean, for instance, the Syrian war. So he was shot down, had to survive 3 days in the Syrian, but why was he there? He was fighting a war. And then one of the scenes later, I don't know if I can find it, but there's a scene at some point when Rick is talking to one of the other test subjects, a male from the Middle East. He says that he lost his whole family in Syria. So maybe there's a certain kind of guilt. And one of the other characters, the nerdy one, who didn't, I forgot to mention something last time. Dang it. I'll have to point that out at the end here. So there is a scene. I totally apologize. I'm not editing this, so I made a mistake, but there's a scene I was going to show you where, this character raises his hand, and there's an interesting element. So I'll do that at the end of this part, if I remember. Hopefully you guys can remind me, and maybe I can do that in a separate one. But anyway, so you have this guy who has, again, himself, he's somewhat lost, and, you know, because he's been lost in the desert for 3 days, right? He's traveled through the desert. Hopefully this gives you something, for several days. But he was fighting a war. So you have these four things up here, and there's a kind of a timeline going on. So in the it ends with this shot. Now, if you're not watching it, they cut out two of the four frames that are on the desk, and they show only the wedding picture and the MIA. Now, this is the key question. Who's the protagonist here? In literary history, there is a tradition of what's called seers, S-E-E-R, people who have beyond the normal ability to see. Now, one of these is Cassandra. Cassandra has the ability to see the future, but the inability to do anything about it. So I think this is actually kind of hearkening to that kind of imagery where she, again, if you think of this as a timeline that we're seeing on this desk, this production design, we now have a happy Abigail who just got her purpose in life was to take care of children, pediatrics, medical doctor, intelligent, and she's beautiful. And then you have an image of her wedding. And on her wedding day, the picture she chooses, the one that's relevant to this movie, is the image of her getting a premonition of the future. And what is the very next image? Her husband is lost in a Syrian war, and she thought he was dead. So there's this whole backstory that's really powerful and that plays into the entirety of the story that we're watching. And if you're not paying attention, you're missing this. And so the story will seem bland and surface level because you're not looking under the surface. Like, that's part of the problem. So she, like, when I first saw this, so, you know, obviously I'm a little more attuned to this, but this is why I want to help open your eyes to what's going on. When the first time I saw this, I did not have all the words that just came out of my mouth explaining this relationship between these four things, but I was instantly struck immediately and powerfully by the look on her face, because that is not the look of a woman who's happily married just recently. And they did that on purpose. Now, all of this happens very quickly. I'm going to show the whole thing. Hold on. So all of that happened really fast, right? And so you only get a couple seconds, even your first time. But the idea that this is not a movie with depth or anything going on is silly. There is so much going on. This all plays into the story. So if you know, who is it that discovers they're all turning into monsters? Who is it that discovers the Homo Titanus? Who is it that takes care of her husband when he becomes sick? Who is it that eventually redeems the beast in the end? And then who is it that chooses the beast and thus her family and her, you know, chosen view in the story or toward the end when she gives him saline instead of the chemical lobotomy? It's all her. She is the one who drives all of the plot structure of this story. She does everything with that. And she, you know, so we hear about, like, there's not female protagonists, but I see this type of story in quite a bit in science fiction. And I think it's silly that feminists don't talk about this. This is a very strong female character who's now she is, you know, it's her thought that she's doing this for her family, her son. So I'm going to show a scene in just a second here. And there's a sense that she is, you know, I'm now fast forward. She's holding, this is a great little image. So you have these two boys. They look like boys in this shot, by the way. Even Sam Worthington looks like a little child, and he is very childlike in this whole thing. And she is kind of the mature adult. And there's a sense of that. And, you know, he is a good father in a certain sense, of course. He takes care of everybody. He's very dutiful. He does what he's supposed to do. But there's not a complexity to him very much at all. He just does what he has to do because that's what he's supposed to do. And who does he rely on for what to do? Boom, his wife. Where is he looking? He's looking at his wife. Where is she looking? Out to the world. So she is actually, and I think this is pretty prominent in literature and in real life. By the way, I believe that women in general are the what I would call the moral gatekeepers and the dominant moral transmitters of any society. They hold the keys to what it is to act morally. I mean, if you think about what it means for a man to, you know, what most men do with their lives is they try to get the woman, and what the woman want what women want determines what kind of a man will become, right? You know, so in some societies, if, you know, there's a joke that's told, that has been told up until, you know, recently, I don't know how recently, but, there are people who have traveled. I haven't traveled to the Middle East, but this is, I read about this from people who traveled there. But the idea, there's a joke that any man who comes out of a, men's bathroom, a public men's bathroom, might be accosted by a woman who asks, "Are you Osama bin Laden?" And they say, the man looks like, no, I am Ahmed or whatever. And she says, "Oh, because the only man is Osama bin Laden. The only man in Egypt is Osama bin Laden. Or the only man in Iran is Osama bin Laden. Or the only man in Saudi Arabia is Osama bin Laden." And the idea is that he was a man because he took certain types of actions. And thus, that's the type of man you should become. And then thus, there's not a coincidence that you have so many terrorists coming out of these places, because that's what the women want. And so, and this is not like a one-off case. This is a very commonly documented idea that these women want a certain type of man. You know, they put up posters of terrorists and they pray to them and types of things. And that's the type of man that men become and do. And so I think there's a power that's often present in literature and history that we don't talk about. And this movie kind of demonstrates it. She is the one who's the moral motivator and guide in this story. And, you know, the doctor who we learn, and this is another thing, the illusion of central position in the Eden complex, which is what's, by the way, is kind of just a way of thinking about how literary elements affect our real world, right? Because each of these literary elements have been pounded into your skull from Star Trek and Star Wars isn't even, whatever. It's not even a sci-fi movie, but in most sci-fi stories, you get a lot of this. Avatar, Minority Report, Men in Black. I mean, whatever it is that you want to watch, the popular ones, Bombs, Space Odyssey, you know, Space 2001: A Space Odyssey. Like, go down the list, and they're all heavily inundated with this. And this is true of the literature, the stories as well. So anyway, look at this character. Excuse me. So she is, you know, standing there in the doorway, in the portal to the room, these two children she's overlooking very lovingly. So she definitely loves them. So you see there's definitely a look of love. She care, you know, that's what her whole life is all about. Now we get this scene with the doctor. Now this doctor is another idea, another trope, and that's the trope of the mad scientist, which I'm going to go into a little bit next time. All I wanted to show you in this one, I'm going to show you another clip in a second, is another sections in a second, is the protagonist between Sam Worthington's character Rick and his wife. And look at, even I didn't even notice this until just now, look at the Netflix description. Even when you read this, the marketing for this, all of it indicates that Rick is the main character. On a bleak future Earth, a soldier endures a radical genetic transformation to save humanity. But his wife, his wife fears he's becoming more creature than man. So there is an indication that there's two important characters here. So that's good. I didn't catch that for that second sentence. Anyway, in the story, I think that the question is, who is the protagonist? I think the wife is the protagonist. Okay, so here are a couple scenes. Again, I want to talk about the relationship between Rick and Abigail, which I think is a bit of a Beauty and the Beast story. And it's also a Promethean story and a couple other stories that I think there's a rich literary tradition going on here. And I think there's a slight little alteration that the creators did here. But again, notice how this is a good imagery. I mean, they're in this bleak world. And they're like, right now, this is a bleak imagery, but they're on this garden and it's cultivated garden. Like, you see all of the, you know, these, again, I'm not an architect. Frank Lloyd Wright-esque architecture is you know, relevant here or anything. I think that's a fair to say that these are kind of Frank Lloyd Wright-esque. They look like they burst out of the rock here. Now, this is a happy scene, right? This is the beginning. Now, I have to say, I know everyone thinks, oh, it's not a big deal, but if you look at good art, every element is important. They could have chosen to include any element here, but they chose him giving her food, and this has such strong fairy tale aesthetics. And in fairy tales, you don't tell people that you love them, you give them food. Or if you hate them, you eat them. Those are the two general options. So he's giving her food. So he loves her. Now it's food for the community and the son. I'm going to skip some of this.
Feel guilty if you let that burn.
Janssen was right.
So notice again, when we're talking about the relationship between Rick and his wife, you know, it seems like a very happy one, but
why the hell did you say yes?
I'd have felt guilty if I hadn't.
That's an important role too, because when we think about his guilt and maybe all of their guilts for the actions they took in the dying world, right? This is a dying world. So all these men took certain actions and they're alive. Part of those actions, they're all soldiers, was probably to kill people.
Guilty if you let that burn.
So notice the song is important. Hey, baby, won't you take a chance? So now this is that night, supposedly she's in the same clothes. She's so drunk, she's fiddling around, like, you know, twirling around. And now notice a really important, so she's stumbling. Now watch this next part. Notice how fast she sobered up. Now, that is not an accident. That's not like bad writing. That's on purpose. They chose this strong, intelligent, that shows her strength, that she was completely wasted and stumbling down the stair or up the stairs. And now when her husband is sick, she, you know, her power kicks in and she grabs him, hoists him up, and brings him to bed. And then, of course, you know, the next scene is she comforts him. Her hands aren't shaking. I think all of that is consciously chosen.
Last one. It's the last one.
So, and then, you know, she comforts him. And then, of course, as that transformation, we have the scientist, but we're going to save the scientist for the next part. Okay, so I do, again, continuing this relationship between the two characters, you know, notice the, you know, he startled what happened right before I pressed pause here. He is startled by a sound while he's cleaning the dishes. This is after he put his son to bed. So he's doing the female duties, by the way. The traditional female duties. He put the kid to bed. He, you know, read bedtime story, or in this case, science to the kid, because the kid's a weirdo. I'm just kidding. And, you know, he's putting away the dishes, and then he hears this splash, and then water. Again, she's in water. Now, it seems silly, but she didn't have to be in water. That was a choice. And then he smiles, of course. He's happy, which is good. Nothing wrong with being happy at seeing your wife swimming. But the point, you know, of course, this is the sex scene. They don't show any sex, so it's not that kind of movie, I guess. But, you know, the point is that this is the scene where they, and this is also the scene where she becomes the first person to notice his, and by the way, this image that you see of the infinity pool type thing on the offset of the stars is really well done. Like, it's good cinematography. We're seeing this imagery, these people, and they seem to be almost, you know, lost in space, like it's melded into one thing. And these kind of stark dichotomies between the earth, water, and this infinite space of deadness that we have to go to is important in this story. Let's see if I can. It's right there. Right here. So his. A lot of the criticism of this story is that it went too slow. You know, it's not a horror story. Well, it's not supposed to be a horror story, or it's not thriller enough for it. But to me, what I'm telling you is that there's layers to this. It's not just a simple slasher flick or something. There's a lot going on here. You know, she's the first one to see this. He doesn't notice it. And there's another scene I'm going to show in a second where one of the big themes we're going to talk about in a future episode is, all the different themes that are going on here. And I think the prominent one is an idea of the individual in relation to the society, which I think is one of the most dominant themes in science fiction, and especially in a Wellesian world. So Wells, you know, versus Jules Verne. So we have Britain, and Jules Verne is French. The two dominant worldviews of their era when they were writing, or, you know, their worldviews is his view was that the purpose of science fiction is to write on social commentary. And most of his stuff is social commentary. So Island of Dr. Moreau is really, you know, a story about civilization and colonialism. And then, you know, you get The Invisible Man, The Invisible Man is about, you know, going invisible and how you relate to society given that, you know, case. But it's also about, another one, the most famous one, The Time Machine, a time traveler who's not even given a friggin' name, right? Again, the illusion of central position. They're not important. This time traveler goes way into the future. And basically what happens is exactly what's happening in the late 19th century with H.G. Wells' society in Britain, where you have as a tunneling and building of these, new subway systems, basically, for the first time. And, you know, this, so you have what he envisioned is like this upper and lower class. So he goes, you know, millions or tens of thousands, I don't remember the number, you know, hundreds of thousands of years in the future. And you get like, I guess it was millions. And you get like the Eloi and the Murlocs, and the Murlocs are, you know, underground, and they're these strong savages that come up and feed on the cattle. That's the Eloi, because they're very weak and feminine. So, but it's basically just a commentary on what's going on in his world between the underground class, is a communist idea, right? And the upper class. So anyway, that's the world that we're living in, remember? And this character, Abigail, is the only one outside. She's now becoming outside of the society. And that's a big part of what's happening, is she's separating from society very slowly. And she's the one who always notices that they're becoming monsters, right? So just real quick, you know, he just comes home from a surgery, and he's being transformed into something, and she doesn't know what it is. So she keeps studying. She's a medical doctor. And, you know, to see what's going on. And again, there's this idea that these are the children and she's the adult, right? That's very, you know, shown here. Now, when we're talking about fairy tale aesthetics, particularly water and of course ice, which is a version of water, of course, it's frozen water. You know, we have that is what life is. Life is often equated with water in the imagery of fairy tales. And if you watch this little scene,
I want to put my hands in there.
So he challenges her to put her hands in the ice bucket. The ice bucket challenge of Rick and Abigail.
So cold.
plenty cold.
So, you know, again, one of the criticisms is that the acting is bland, but I think the acting conveys, you know, the acting allows for the getting out of the way of us focusing on the actor and focusing on the questions that's going on. So how else could he have conveyed that scene? Like, why is my hands not cold? Ah, the heavens. Like, what the fuck do the people want? Like, he is a soldier who went through the desert for 3 days and survived. He's a dutiful guy, and he has a little bit of curiosity, but really he just does what he's supposed to do because that's what he's supposed to do. She's the one who conveys all the curiosity in the story. Now, what's going on with this water is that he's no longer of Earth. He's not a human. And that's what we find out, right? So in science fiction and fairy tale, there's this relationship between what it means to be human, what it means to be other than that. In the Wellesian story, you have the turning in of animals by vivisection into men and what it means to be an animal, or particularly what it means to be a man. And that's the same thing we're getting here. Where is the humanity? That's one of the big questions in this story. What is humanity? I mean, if we do evolve, and this, remember, the premise of this is forced evolution. If we evolve into something more, what will anything of our humanness remain, and what would that be? And that's the same thing with the characters in H.G. Wells' story, because in that, there's even a mantra that I don't remember, that they're always told, you know, we are men, we stand on 2 feet, and, you know, stand on 2 feet, are we not men, right? We you know, put clothes on, we don't go around naked. And these are rules established by Dr. Moreau to control the men, these, you know, new, quote-unquote, new men. And we have similar kinds of rules that we're going to be having in this story. But anyway, I just wanted to show that little sequence. And then we're going to go into a little bit, a last bit of Abigail's character, although there's a lot to say about her. Okay, in another pivotal scene, this is the only one with who's really supposed to be conveying very strong emotions, of course, in this story is Abigail, based on her character. Although she's very Cassandra-like in the sense that she has a vision, a certain sense of, you know, female intuition, if you want to call it, of the future. But here's a sequence where after Rick goes through his surgery for eyesight, right? Because he has to have a different type of eye structure or whatever when he goes on to Titan, the moon of Saturn. And now, at this point in the story, Abigail is aware of the idea of Homo Titanius. And she wants, so the idea of forced evolution, which was not talked about by the doctor. So we're going to talk about the deception of the doctor in a future episode. But that this is important of what's going on with her character and what she's being, you know, what she's feeling right now, and then what she's trying to get out of this doctor now. So she's crossed the line.
It's surgery.
That's not going to happen.
So this is what they have to do to, because basically he's going through certain issues and he needs a surgery, they're saying, to basically for the final transition.
Without it, Rick's brain will...
Tell me the truth.
Stop it.
No! I won't sit here and watch him turn my husband into a fucking animal.
So again, this story is so aware of its Wellesian roots, of its, you know, and look how she's, you know, even, you know, I think the look on her face is perfect. She's very staunch. You know, people would say, oh, she's not conveying much emotion. I don't know how much emotion she's supposed to be conveying. She's supposed to be, in this moment, I think, strong. You know, getting out of the way of the story, I think, is a really important thing that these actors are conveying, right? When you're in a sci-fi story that's not real, the idea of an actor conveying and selling or, you know, showing these ideas without too much getting in the way of it is a very difficult thing to do as an actor, I would imagine. But, you know, notice the garden around her. She's haloed, in a sense, by a garden as she's, you know, kind of challenging the doctor by telling him, no, she's not going to do it. And she's, you know, I think, personally, I think that she's not overdoing it is important.
We are in uncharted waters, Abigail.
So I don't want to give too much of that away because we're going to be talking about his philosophy and what he did in a second, or in the next episode, I should say. Okay, now I want to show, this has turned into a Beauty and the Beast type of a story. And, you know, check it out. Now this beast, Rick, who is turned into an animal, and I want to send you in while you turn my husband into a fucking animal. And look, she turns away from him. Right? It's exactly like what happens in Beauty and the Beast. She's disgusted by him. She's, you know, she can't stand him. Even though it's not his fault, that's what's going on with this. And she has separated herself from the society of her husband. She can't be with him. You know, again, she is disgusted. Okay, now the scene when she sees him fully done. Again, this is the fully formed beast, transformed by the mad scientist, rather than a fairy godmother, or an evil spirit, I should say, from Beauty and the Beast. Which, again, there's not much structure or content to evil spirit. Now we have an evil spirit. Now watch this. This is, he's trying to make a connection, and she's
they
not
communicate
having
at low frequency and tactile contact. Our hearing can't detect it. They can go home until we launch.
Earth is no longer their home. They're Titanius. Right? Titan is their home. Homo Titanius. So here he realizes. Now, remember in the story how he has always looked at her or for her. He's like been a child reliant on her. Now he feels kind of betrayed, and this is part of the conflict now. Now we don't know how this monster is going to react. Again, this is why I wish I could just bitch slap some of these fucking critics, because they're all, like, every single one of them are a bunch of morons. There's so much going on in this thing. So I hope you're helping me save the Titan and Netflix here. So again, this is there's a big conflict going on, because at this point in the story, you don't know what's going to happen. I don't care who you think you are. You don't know.
Still am, Abby.
Is it? So he's going to go home. So he's having trouble putting something as simple as putting on his clothes, he's having trouble with. Like a child, right? Like he's a new person. So this is an important scene too. And again, you know, with her character, now she's going to help him. And
looks like it's just a little tight, you know. I just have to get to the larger side.
Beauty and the Beast. Will she accept him or not? He's a brutal beast, and he can't have her anymore. They're separated. Sorry, they are separated by a whole species. Now, this is the scene. This is after the scene when the other survivor of the test, the female, I don't remember her name right now, but the female Homo Titanus, who had slain her husband, comes over to Rick, and I think the assumption is that she's trying to convince Rick to slay his wife, Abigail. Now these soldiers, these faceless soldiers, come in to stop him, hopefully to get it survived, but they kill the female. And now, watch what happens, and we'll talk about it.
Rick! Rick!
Without her and
no!
With her. So he's a beast without her. Where's the humanness in him? From her. Now he's ashamed, he runs away. See, I think there's so much going on about what's there's so much going on in this story and what's important with it. And the stuff going on with the story, you have to have some subtext or some of the sub layers. I think it really helps having a literary knowledge, but I don't think it, you have to have it. You know, the cinematography points you in the direction, the acting, like that moment right there, there was just a subtle amount, which is to me what art is. Art is not overdoing it. It's the subtleties. And so there was a subtle amount of the shame. So even if you don't know about literary history and, you know, the redeeming character of the female, which, you know, goes back to Dante and Beatrice, which is, you know, she's the one who takes Dante to Paradiso, right? Like there's Virgil who takes him through Purgatorio and through hell and Purgatorio. But then Virgil can't go to heaven because he's pre-Christ. So it has to be another character. So this is Beatrice, which is actually a real world character from Dante's life who he fell in love with, blah, blah. And she's the one who does it. And then Beatrice is this redeeming character, this Madonna figure, and she actually is in one of my favorite Hawthorne short stories, Nathaniel Hawthorne, Rappaccini's daughter, which really H.G. Wells drew on for his imagery, and that, you know, is present in science fiction to this day. The structure and the development of the Eden complex comes directly from, particularly from the mesmeric. This is my wording, mesmeric imagery and style of Nathaniel Hawthorne. So that's what's happening right here, right? Is she has been that character for the Rick, and now she has to, or now she has abandoned him, or she had up until this point. Now she realizes that he needs her. Now we're not gonna watch this whole scene, but I just wanted to show you Rick has run away. And she knows where he is because he's still Rick a little bit, but he's not. So there's still a question to some degree, and we don't know. So the question is, the doctor, the mad scientist said he's still Rick, but we don't really know that because we just saw, for instance, the other female Homo Titanias kill her husband. So we don't know, like, it's not clear what Rick is going to do here. Now she comes out. This is where he showed her earlier. It's too bad, you know, this place is beautiful. It's too bad we can't save it. Right. And again, this is a Beauty and the Beast sequence for sure. Right. She's come home to him. She left him just like in Beauty and the Beast. She left him to go away. Right. But then she has to come back of her own free will and accept him as a beast. I'm skipping around if you're listening. So right now she's walking up to him. She put out her hand to him, a loving gesture in his world as much as hers. And then I'm skipping a little bit. So they touch for the first time, really. And then she does the fairy tale thing. What is the fairy tale thing? Dun, dun, dun. I didn't realize this. A 3-minute long sequence. But you notice there's a river in the background. It's dark, right? So we have that fairy tale aesthetic, stark contrast of light and dark, water and land. Seems simple. And then she kisses the beast. And then, of course, the enemy comes. Okay, so I skipped a whole bunch of sequences because it'll be covered in the next section when we talk about the mad scientist. But I want to end with this. And I know I said I was going to talk about that guy who raised his hand, but it's already gone for way longer than I wanted it to. So I'm going to stop after this. But for this part two, I'll have to do a whole part just on that guy waving his hand. So in this part, the character, this character here talks about the, he sees Rick and he sees that there is something going on and he says, you know, oh wow, I can't believe he did it. So this is an outsider. This is covered in one of the earlier sections when he is from space. He's from NASA. Okay. So here is, so this, what we're talking about here is another society, NASA versus the bioengineering NATO little garden that they created. But let us talk about that in a future episode.
Yeah.
Probably not necessary. That line, but...
Rick changes everything. He gives us hope. Your family's a miracle, Dr. Jensen.
Your family is a miracle, Dr. Jensen. So this is going to hark toward a future episode when we talk about themes, but the idea that her family, you know, what makes her family? And we talked about that with Abigail throughout this whole thing is, you know, her character is what holds the whole thing together. And I think what pushes everything forward. And it also tells you a lot about the plot, because if you ever want to know what a plot is, you want to look at the main character, their motives, and what pushes them forward. And in this case, you have a conflict of two plots. You have the mad scientist, which we're going to talk about next, and then you have Abigail's plot and what she wants and what she hopes for. Remember, she's the visionary Cassandra. She sees something, and then he gets lost in the desert, and she starts to see something now, and sight is always very important in fairy tale aesthetics, who sees the evil and so on and so forth. And that's really, really incredible. Okay, so I hope, I assume you've seen this, and for the next part, we're going to talk about the mad scientist. And then I think the final part, we will talk about themes and what's going on throughout the whole story. So, but what I hope is that I know this is a whole long thing, this whole, 4-part series, they're like 40 to 60 minutes now. And the movie's only 90 minutes. But what I hope that this does, and I hope that you will join me in trying to save the Titan, Netflix's The Titan, by getting people to watch it. And if you think that this is too much analysis of one movie, I don't think of it as analysis. I think of it as educating on literature and the layers within this story to kind of teach you about movies and criticism and the ideas present in science fiction and all these things that this movie, which is really, really well done, deserves so much more than the crappy critics we have today. So go out there, spread the word, tell people, go watch this I hope you tell people to go themselves and watch the movie and enjoy the great protagonist, Abigail.